Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Salman Rushdie, who has a new collection of nonfiction titled Step Across This Line. Most recent novel is Fury, known for such works as The Moor's Last Sigh, Satanic Verses, and Midnight's Children. Salman Rushdie, how did you become a writer? You say you went to England when you were 13 years old.
That's right.
Okay. Your family was wealthy then?
Yeah. I mean, my family was, they weren't super rich, but they were pretty well off. So I was brought up in a very comfortable business, middle-class Indian family, upper-middle-class Indian family, I guess, in Bombay. And Bombay in the 50s was an extraordinary place. I mean, I was a kid, but even people who were grown-ups at the time might say that it was a city at a great moment, you know, a city at a great cosmopolitan, vibrant, cultured moment. And I felt that, you know, it was a lot of what formed me was the atmosphere of that city in those days, that very cosmopolitan, open society, you know. My mother tells me that when I was 10 or 11 years old, and people used to say to me, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up, little boy? I mean, everybody else in those days was saying they wanted to be an astronaut because this was just around the time of, you know, Yuri Gagarin and all that, the first astronauts or cosmonauts. Everyone wanted to do that. Space, you know, space was the career move. I used to say, apparently, that I wanted to be a writer.
Did you read much?
Yeah, I was a kind of big reader as a kid.
What were you reading?
I read a lot in English, English children's books. But the English children's books, the English language children's books that got to India, it was a bit unpredictable, you know. I mean, certain things which any kid in England would have read, you know, like, let's say, Winnie the Pooh, you know, we never got. Because I don't know why Winnie the Pooh didn't make the journey to India, but he never did. I think he was too busy in the 100-acre wood. But other books did. I mean, there were these children's books about kids who went boating in the Lake District by somebody called Arthur Ransom that were very popular. There were dreadful, in retrospect, First World War flying ace stories about somebody called Biggles, Squadron Leader Biggles. They had lots of that. There were, in fact, absurd, romanticized English boarding school stories set around a fat boy called Billy Bunter that we used to read about. And what that meant is that when I was sent to an English boarding school, I had this completely mistaken view that I knew what it was going to be like. It wasn't like that.
And then you were there, and you began writing at that point, or when you were a teenager then?
Yeah, I mean, I did. You know, I was very good at English. You know, I used to always do very well at English. Increasingly, as a teenager, I became more and more keen on the thought that I might be a writer, you know, and really never had a plan B, except that I did also have a sort of itch to be an actor. And I did a lot of, at school and at college, I did a lot of acting in undergraduate drama societies and so on. And actually, even after leaving Cambridge University, the London stage in those days had boasted a really vibrant fringe, a kind of off Broadway thing. And I was very involved in that. But frankly, in the end, I was starving to death and decided I better try the other route.
You actually thought you could make a living at that?
No. I mean, I think the thing about starving to death as an actor is it makes it relatively clear to you straight away that there are much better people around. And acting was always the big itch. You know? Anyway, I just thought I'd scratch it. Yeah, no, I mean, I always mostly wanted to be a writer, and when I was discovered that acting really wasn't hacking it, you know, or I wasn't hacking it as an actor, I did concentrate on the writing. It took me a long time. It took me a long time to find my way as a writer, you know. And I left university in 1968. You know, Midnight's Children came out at the beginning of 81, and it took me 12 years to learn how to do it.
Magic realism informs your work. Were you a big fan of the of the Latin American magic realists?
Yeah, I mean, it was Borges first. I mean, Garcia Marquez I discovered later on, but ever since I was a college student, I'd read the work of Borges, and then through him had discovered other Latin American writers. But you see, I I've always slightly resisted the term magic realism because I think it really describes that particular school of Latin American writers, you know, and it's in the way that surrealism describes a particular school of artists and writers in France at a certain time. You know, fabulism is a term which describes a certain group of American writers at a certain right. time. They're kind of all the same thing, you know. I mean, there's not really any difference between surrealism and magic realism, you know, apart from the language it's written in. I mean, magic realism is mostly in Spanish and surrealism mostly in, you know, French or English. But I've felt that out of the tradition that I was writing from, that's to say an Indian tradition which was very well versed in the literature of the fantastic, you know, whether it be the classics of India like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana or the Arabian Nights stories which I was sort of brought up with, the idea that stories are not true, you know, was something that we grew up with, that you know that the fictionality of fiction, you know, is very uppermost in the minds of people who have that tradition behind them. So I tried to combine that, in a way, with very closely observed naturalism, you know, because, I mean, in fact, Midnight's Children is extremely naturalistic in its settings and in its historical moments. You know, it's a book anchored in places and dates, you know, so what I felt was that these elements of the fantastic could in fact be ways of enriching the natural rather than getting away from it, you know. So in the phrase magic realism, my interest was much more in the realism than on the magic, you know. And it was very strange when that book came out, the way in which it was responded to in the West. People in the West tended to stress the fantasy elements, you know, of the book. In India, it was read as a history book.
Well, I don't know if it's that much difference, really, than with, say, you know, Macondo in 100 Years of Solitude, yeah, where all of the fantastic elements, not the pig's tails and the mm-hmm. flying to the sky, but some of the other elements, the massacres, were all real.
Yeah, well, that's what happened. I've had that at the time that I read 100 Years of Solitude, I'd never been to Latin America. When I did go, I had exactly that experience of people saying to me, oh, you know, that when this in this chapter of the book, I can tell you what that's based on and so on. Similar thing happened to me. I mean, I remember going to India on a book tour, not unlike this one, soon after Midnight's Children came out. And I remember a reader coming up to me in my hometown of Bombay and saying, I could have written that book. He said, I know all that stuff, you know, which I took to be a great compliment because it meant that I was describing a reality that he recognized, you know, to be true. But in India, as I say, the magic elements of the book were in a way understressed. You know, people read it as their story.
One of the essays in Step Across This Line concerns Indians writing in English.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, that's the early 80s, 1981, that group of people did not yet exist.
Didn't exist. Now, I mean, at the risk of sounding immodest, I think Midnight's Children did open that door, you know, and I think many people of the younger writers who came after Midnight's Children have being kind enough, more or less, to say so. You know, I think the success of Midnight's Children, not only the success internationally, but the success of Midnight's Children in India, gave a whole generation of writers the confidence or the sense of freedom that they could use English in whatever way they chose, rather than in a kind of very classicist, Fausterian way, which had been the previous inclination. It just gave people the confidence that English could be a voice through which they could speak. And, you know, suddenly this flood came pouring through the gates. And I mean, of course, many of them are writers very, very, very different to myself. I mean, it's not like they're all writing copies of Midnight's Children. You know, in fact, many of them, you know, in a way, write against Midnight's Children. I mean, which is fine, because that's one always a way in which writers define themselves. They try to define themselves against what was there before. But I think it did open that door, and I'm extremely proud of that.
Do you feel that that was the book that had you find your voice, or do you feel that Satanic Verses did? Or?
No, I think Midnight's Children was the one where I had the sense. I mean, my first novel, which is a sort of rather unsuccessful science fictionish novel, when I look at that now, the thing that embarrasses me about it is that it doesn't sound like my voice. It sounds like somebody who hasn't found out yet, you know. Whereas in Midnight's Children, I mean, it sounds like me to me, you know, for good or ill, you know, but at least it does. And ever since then, I've actually known how to write, you know, my sentences and my stories, you know, my books. The Satanic Verses, oddly, I felt to be my most personal and least political novel. Just goes to show how wrong you can be. But having written Midnight's Children about India and Shame, more or less, about Pakistan, I thought it was time that my writing made the migration that I had made, you know, and that it began to discuss the condition of people who came from one world into another, primarily in the book from India into England. And that's what I thought I was writing about. I thought I was writing about the most personal material of my own life and the least political. And whereas Midnight's Children and Shame are pretty, you know, have fairly overt political content in terms of, you know, Mrs. Gandhi being more or less the villain of Midnight's Children and a version of Pakistani dictator being one of the fictionalized characters in Shame, not in the Satanic Verses, you know. And I mean, well, turns out I was wrong.
How did you find out that, I mean, okay, you sit there, you write this book, which you kind of figure is another in the canon of Salman Rushdie. Fine, you know, it fits in yeah. your own sequence of your life and the timeline of your writing. How did you find out that something was different? Was it at the time the fatwa was issued, or
no,
was it before that?
It was before. I mean, the book came out in, it didn't, you see, in America, the book got published at more or less the same time as the fatwa in early 89. But in England, it had come out 6 months earlier. And between September 88 and February 89, there had been 6 months of arguing about it, you know, in England, with various Muslim leaders, I mean, imams and so on, in England, taking exception to it. And there was a part of me that thought, that's okay. You know, it was clear to me writing the book that that a certain kind of person wasn't going to like it.
So you kind of knew when you were writing it.
Well, I knew there'd be an argument, you know, because there'd been an argument about every book I'd ever written. And it seemed to me, and it still does seem to me, that it's one of the functions of literature to start useful arguments. You know, just to start the kind of arguments by which people can clarify their thinking and perhaps even move on a step, you know. And so if books carry out that function, then that's, in my view, fine. Not only fine, but necessary. So I thought, yeah, there'd probably be a bit of an argument. But how big an argument can it be? You know, I mean, this is a 550-page literary novel.
Right.
And, you know, so if there's an argument, it's going to be at the kind of level that books do generate, you know. And there, indeed, it had been like that. And I thought that there was actually, in the argument that took place in those 6 months before the fatwa, I thought there was much of value that came out, you know, in terms of how people were arguing out the case, you know. And I thought this could just be, you know, even socially, culturally valuable, this kind of row. I mean, the problem with the Khomeini intervention is that it changed the conversation. You know, it stopped being a conversation about ideas, you know, good book, bad book. It stopped being an argument about how one can tell or retell the grand narratives by which people live, you know, such as religion. All that went out the window. You know, suddenly it became an argument about life and death, about terrorism and freedom, etc. You know, it changed the subject.
And it changed you. I mean, up until that point, I've interviewed writers for many years, literary writers, science fiction writers, mystery writers, and some of them have a following, some of them don't. Obviously, you had a following. You was securing your place as a literary author. Mm. Suddenly, Salman Rushdie stops being this guy who sits in front of his computer or typewriter or whatever you were using at the time and becomes this other person. How disconnected did you feel?
Very. In the initial stages, very much very disconnected. Because, you know, in the initial stages, it was very difficult for me to go on arguing back. You know, and I was suddenly obliged to disappear, rather against my will. But, you know, the security forces were quite insistent at the beginning, you know. So suddenly I became, at precisely the moment at which my name became, you know, front page news, I became invisible, you know. And it allowed all sorts of people, both sympathetic and unsympathetic and everywhere in between, to, so to speak, to make me up, you know. So there were versions of me. There were all these people with my name stuck on them, you know, walking around the media and, you know, given a kind of credibility by my inability to pop up and say, actually, that's not me, this is me. So for the first year or so, a lot of those virtual Rushdies, you know, got a lot of airtime. And in a way, I've spent a lot of the rest of my life getting rid of them.
How could you write? How could you conceive of creating another novel under those conditions?
Well, it was very difficult. I mean, I was kind of knocked for six, and I was very off balance and very despondent, you know, about the reception of my work and the kind of, as I saw it, the way in which my work had been twisted and misrepresented and, you know, and of course vilified and of course burned, and so on. And it shook me profoundly.
At the same time, The Satanic Verses, a literary novel, sat at the top of the New York Times bestseller list for like a year.
Yes, it did very well. So that was the upside.
You became a household name, whether you wanted to or not.
Well, there was this strange thing that until the publication of Harry Potter, the Satanic Verses held the record not for the most copies ever sold, but for what they call the fastest sale. You know, the largest number of copies sold in a 1 week period or a 2 week period. That's the record that I held, which I'm afraid J.K. Rowling blasted me into that pinnacle.
Well, here in Berkeley, there were signs, you know, I am Salman Rushdie.
Yeah, and I got some of those button badges myself, T-shirts, because after all, I am Salman Rushdie. So I thought I should have one or two as well. No, I mean, I think one of the things I've really taken away from that whole episode is how amazing it was to be at the receiving end of not just of all the attacks, you know, but of all the support. I mean, I think in a way, for me, the residue has to do with that. It has to do with the enormous amount of friendship and solidarity and practical support and courage, you know, on the part of booksellers right here in Berkeley, you know, at Cody's and at Black Oak and so on. I mean, Cody's, after all, was firebombed, you know, and happily nobody was hurt. But it was a scary time, and in order to confront this threat, it was something which required a collective act. It wasn't just me, you know. It was a collective act by publishers and booksellers, and I must say by ordinary readers, because when you're talking about how the big sale of the Static Verses, a lot of that. Well, of course, some of it was just curiosity, because that happens, you know. But a lot of it was as an expression of support. What could people do? They could go and buy the book.
How hard was it to go through all of those papers and things you had written to come up with the sequence that appears as a large chunk of Step Across This Line?
Well, it was tough. But in the end, I thought it was, in a way, for me, the most rewarding exercise in this book, because I thought, I can't pretend those years didn't happen. I've got to, if I'm talking about what I wrote non-fictionally in that decade, I've got to take on the fact that that was such a big part of that decade. But when I looked at this folder of stuff, you know, a lot of it was very much yesterday's papers. A lot of it was polemical argument, letters to the papers, speechifying. A lot of it was very repetitive.
Do you ever feel a little embarrassed by some of the things you wrote at the height of going crazy?
There? Yes, of course. And I mean, and the great thing about collecting a book is that you don't have to include that stuff. you could allow that to be forgotten, because everybody makes mistakes and says stupid things and things that they wish they
hadn't. You're a little under a little pressure at the time.
But when you're trying to say, you know, here is a version that I want to stand for some time, then you really have to consider what you want to put out there as the truthful version of how it felt to be me, you know, in that time. So in the end, what I did is I took from what must have been 300 or 400 pages of material, you know, I took a selection and then rewrote it. I mean, it's probably the part of the book that's most worked on, you know, there, partly just technically in order to cut out repetition. You know, if I say something in 1 month, I don't have to say it the next year, you know, but also to make a kind of mixture of moods so that some of that passage, that part of the book, is very personal. Some of it is just about what it was like to be in my shoes day by day. Some of it is more, you know, contemplative or intellectual or whatever. I wanted a whole picture, a picture, let's say, which would make it unnecessary for me for a very long time to write an autobiography. You know?
Well, it's interesting as you're talking, and I keep thinking that section of the book could have been a novel, a strange novel, perhaps even written by Salman Rushdie, about a writer who writes a novel and has this reaction.
Yeah, but you know, the thing I thought, the reason why it strikes me that it should not be told in fiction is that the thing that is interesting about the fatwa and the Khomeini years is that it's true. I mean, that, you know, the thing that makes it interesting, because if it was a fiction, then so what, you know? I mean, the thing that's interesting is that at this moment in the history of the world, you know, the medievalist tyrant of a distant country with whom I had nothing to do could try and reach across the world using all the resources of modern technology and weaponry to kill somebody who was a citizen of another country. I mean, that was the shocking thing. The shocking thing was that it was, in a way, anachronistic. You know, how could such a thing happen now, people thought, when it started, you know. One of the awful things about our world now is that what was thought, what in those days, I mean, as recently ago as 1989, seemed almost unthinkable, is now very thinkable, you know, and that's how far we've deteriorated.
I was stunned in reading that section to see how little support you got from governments.
Yeah, it was very difficult. Everybody, you know, spoke with forked tongues because governments, you know, have or believe they have higher concerns. And in many cases, those higher concerns were actually rather brutal, such as the fact that, you know, Denmark imported a lot of, or sold or exported a lot of feta cheese to Iran, and they were worried about endangering the feta cheese exports. I remember having a meeting with the then foreign minister of Germany, and Germany at that point was Iran's number one trading partner in the world. And I remember him saying, I am not going to jeopardize the economic interests of Germany for your sake. So all that was going on. I certainly got an education in the hard realities of politics in those days.
You wrote a book called Harun and the Sea of Stories, which predates J.K. Rowling. You were there first.
Yeah, no, I was ahead of the wave. I mean, it's true that these days, if you talk to publishers, the hot thing is what's called crossover fiction. You know, and clearly the success of Harry Potter, followed by the success of the Philip Pullman books and so on, you know, Terry Pratchett. I mean, there's a whole range of writers now who are very, very successfully managed to surf that wave towards untold wealth. You know. I mean, Harun really was the one that did it first. And I'm happy to be able to talk about, we should talk about the fact that it's going to be done at Berkeley, you know, because the play version of Harun, which was originally, which I collaborated with others on making the stage adaptation, was originally done at the National Theatre in London about 4 years ago. And I have to say, it was kind of magical production. It was one of the absolutely delightful to watch it. And the Berkeley rep has said they want to do a production, and so it's going to be here in November.
Salman Rushdie, your last book was Fury, which did not get the kind of reviews that many of your previous works had gotten. And in reading it, what I saw in that book was this incredible anger.
Well, it's a book about incredible anger. You know, I mean, I think I saw around me incredible anger and wanted to make it the subject of a book. You know, I mean, of course, you know, I've got my share of anger. I mean, I had things happen to me which would make plenty of people angry. But it wasn't my anger that I was writing about. I mean, actually, where I found the model for the fury inside Professor Salanka, if anywhere, was not me, but my father, who's no longer alive. But my father, who was actually rather like Professor Salanka, a very charming man, a kind of completely delightful company, but had this savage rage that would burst out of him, you know, and scare everybody. You know, and I grew up with that, and that's where it came from. I wanted to write about that, about him in a way, more than me.
Why do you think it didn't get the critical response?
Oh, I don't know. You know, everybody gets their time. You know, it's time to beat somebody up. I mean, that always happens. Sometimes I think that people were so, that during the years when I was in serious trouble, you know, there was all this support and solidarity, and then there didn't need to be nice to me anymore, so I think
they came down on you.
Yeah, I think there was a kind of build-up of unspoken hostility that finally found its way into the press. But, you know, the fact is that now, going around the country, the response to Fury that I've been experiencing from readers around the country is gigantic, you know?
But there's one segment in it, and I remember it. You were supposed to be here on September 13th, and as you said before we went on the air, you were stranded in Texas. There's a segment where he gets into a cab, and the cab driver does this rant.
Yes.
And I swear, I read that a week before September 11th, a week and a half before September 11th. It was like right out of the news.
Well, I mean, it is. I guess it's true that if you're good at your job, you can sometimes have your finger on some pulse. You know, I mean, obviously, I had no idea what was going to happen, but you know, what I did have a sense of in New York was the sense that this extraordinary golden moment in the history of the city must be of short duration, because such moments always are. You know, that there's an illusion of eternity, but actually these are very fragile moments in history. And so I had, the book is informed by that kind of sense of an ending, which of course then looks prescient, you know, with hindsight. But the other thing also that the book does, which looks outside, which goes broader than just New York City, Professor Salanka, who after all is a person originally from India via England, so he has both a kind of third world and a European perspective that he brings to America, is aware of the fact that the rage inside him, in his view, connects to a kind of wider fury, you know, in the world. And he has that sense, and the novel has this sense, of a darkening cloud over America, you know, and of these kind of the wings of the Furies beating overhead, because, in a way, of the colossal power and success of America and the envies and resentments that bred. So, yeah, I mean, the book was about that, and then, by golly, it came true.
There are fundamentalist Jews, there are fundamentalist Christians, there are fundamentalist Muslims, and we don't hear much about India, but your book and works by people like Arundhati Roy tell us there are fundamentalists Hindus as well.
In India, that's the biggest problem right now, yes.
What do you think is going on?
How long have you got? You know? But in one of the things I think it is that the modern world has become a place where two things are happening. One is the rate of change is incredibly fast, and the other is that uncertainty is at all-time high. And in that such situation, extreme religion offers people the illusion of certainty. You know, it says, just believe in this, hold on to this, and everything will be fine. Live by this, you know. And I think in this world of such, you know, such fluidity and shapelessness, the simple truths of fanatical religion seem to offer people a way, you know. And I think that's a part of the reason.
It's scary for us. It's scary for me when I see, you know, a man like I'm terrified by John Ashcroft. Mm-hmm. You know, I can talk to people who say, well, you know, Osama bin Laden and company, the big evil, and Ashcroft's the small evil, and maybe right now. But 10 years from now, that could change.
Well, I think it's true that one of the big debates, it's one of the things I really tried to write a lot about in this book, one of the debates of the next, perhaps for the next generation, is going to be the question of how you make the balance between security and freedom. You know, and I think it's a very large issue for any democratic society, you know, because clearly the reason for the security is you believe you're protecting something of value, you know, and if the act of protecting the thing of value actually destroys it, then you've created a very damaging paradoxical situation, to say the least, you know. And I think that is going to be more and more the subject, you know. I mean, terrorism is a dreadful thing and needs to be fought and so on, you know, but we mustn't do it to ourselves.
What could be the role of a writer such as yourself?
Just this. This is the only role a writer has, is to sound off, you know, to say his piece, both in print and every so often, you know, outside print, I mean, in person. I mean, I think there are writers who are temperamentally not like this, and that's okay too. But the kind of writer that I have always been, I mean, since long before the fatwa, was that I believed that, yes, you make your books, and anyway, my books have always been very involved with the relationship between the public sphere and the private sphere. You know, but you do that, and you do that at its own speed. But then every so often, it becomes necessary, or it feels necessary to me, to roll my sleeves up and dive into the argument of whatever is going on at the time. And that's all there is. I mean, unfortunately, I don't run the world.
Salman Rushdie, are you working on a novel now?
Yeah.
How far into it are you?
Quite a long way. I mean, quite a long way. I've done everything except write anything that I really like.
What happens when you go through that process and you're not happy?
I do a lot of architectural work before I start writing. I mean, I always do a lot of planning and note-taking and sketches and, you know, things like that. I mean, for months and months, you know. And then you just have to try and find the door into the work, you know, and you keep going through wrong doors, and there's just a brick wall on the other side. And I mean, at the moment, I've got several chunks of it that I do quite like, but I haven't yet found the way in which they add up. You know, I haven't found the road. One of the few things that you learn from experience as a writer, because you don't learn much, is that in the end, if you keep hammering away at it, it reveals itself to you. I mean, that doesn't happen by inspiration. It happens by hammering away at it.
You've been listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest book, collection of essays, is Step Across This Line. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.